Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
I'm looking at Tesla. That stock has been in the news
Every day.
This year, the stock is really underperforming, down 37%. So it seems like an odd time for Tesla. We'll ask shareholders to vote again on the same $56 billion compensation package for Chief Executive Officer Elon Musk that was voided by a Delaware court early this year. Craig Trudell joins us. He covers all that auto stuff for Bloomberg. It's just amazing here, Craig. It seems like an odd time to be asking for this monster's payday here. What's going on at Tesla, the board, and Elon?
Yeah, it's not a huge shock in that we sort of heard the complaining about this ruling as soon as it hit. We saw it play out on X, as you would expect. But it is, I was surprised to see that, you know, their move here was to take the same plan and just put it back to the shareholders. It's a fairly simple one, but it does seem like a pretty bold one, just given the very thorough, case that was laid out by the Delaware Chancery Court, against the company, in particularly the board. I mean, the language that Judge Kathleen McCormick used was pretty notable. She described the directors as, and I quote, supine servants of an overweening master. She just had a lot of real zingers about this board. And for them to, respond to that by, doing it over again is really something.
Just to be clear, we're talking $56 billion, like with a B?
With a B, yeah.
How do we get to that?
If you want to defend the board here, of course they did. We constantly referred to this pay package as a moonshot award, right? And it absolutely was. It was setting targets that nobody thought was at all possible, that the company wouldn't be able to pull off. It was based on performance of the company and its earnings and market value. And I think there was a combination of Musk absolutely pulling miracles in terms of the earnings performance of this company that no one saw coming. But it was also the case that, this company was the sort of poster boy for the ZIRP era and, a meme stock, right? And we don't get there without, the enthusiasm that Musk managed to pull off in addition to turning this company into a car company to really, take seriously.
All right, so they're also looking to reincorporate, I guess, in a friendlier jurisdiction, maybe get out of Delaware and get to the great state of Texas. Is that all tied together with this?
They interestingly do lay out in the proxy that they wanted to sort of put this to shareholders together. They didn't want to be perceived as basically running from Delaware in response to the ruling and going to Texas where they would be treated differently. They wanted to have shareholders get another opportunity to say yay or nay to this and give them an opportunity to weigh in on whether they should change the incorporation. I think it still remains to be seen, you know, just exactly how this can work out legally speaking, this idea that a court would make this ruling and the company would, you know, basically just have shareholders perform a do-over after the judge, you know, said that they, you know, did not look out for the best interests of shareholders. You know, I guess if you're Tesla, the argument you make here is that, well, you know, you just exposed this idea that we apparently did enough and broke it down and you know, pretty damning detail. The investors know now, the shareholders can vote again, and if they vote in favor, then you know, what's your problem, essentially?
There too. I want to transition to Continental, which is an auto parts company, really. That stock is down over 5% over in Germany, and I say that because their results were worse than feared, and this all points to the current auto market isn't doing too great, and then the also EV market isn't doing too great, and for Continental, that squeezes on both sides.
Yeah, I think they've been a company that really has struggled with this transition, you know, really, like, very, very much been in a position of being caught flat-footed in terms of being ready for electrification, and has made a lot of moves to try and address that haven't gone particularly smoothly. And so, in addition to this idea that, you know, the auto market is showing some signs of strain under the pressure of higher interest rates, making it more difficult for consumers to be able to afford big purchases like a new car. It's also very much a case specific to this company where they're really trying to remake themselves and struggling to do so.
Craig, where are we now just in kind of the market's perception of overall end demand for EVs? I mean, is this just a bump in the road that an industry that's undergoing a long-term transition should expect to see, or is there something more fundamental going on out there?
Yeah, it's a good question, because I think even folks who cover this just religiously, our colleagues at Bloomberg New Energy Finance, I think they were initially reluctant to sort of come around to this idea of an EV slowdown and sort of, you know, had a view that, you know, people were more pessimistic than was really warranted. And this was as, you know, a lot of headlines were coming out late last year, early this year. I think when Tesla reported their first quarter deliveries and it came in so far short of everyone's expectations, you know, the consensus was coming down and down going into that report. And yet even then, the company came up, you know, tens of thousands of vehicles short of where people were seeing them, you know, report. I think even BNEF now is very much concerned about, you know, the magnitude of deceleration that we've seen and the challenges that we're seeing, particularly in a market like the U.S., where you would think that at this point, you know, this many years into this transition and with all the investment that companies are making, that surely we would start to see, you know, more momentum, or at least a healthier continuation of momentum. Instead, we've seen a real slowdown. And I think, you know, even Biden's Inflation Reduction Act does a lot of the right things to try and, you know, move this part of the industry forward. And yet execution has been a challenge.
Hey, Craig, thanks a lot. Craig Trudell, Bloomberg Global Autos Editor. Super appreciate it. And we are at a Bloomberg NEF conference right now. But I think that does point to the fact that we don't actually know how this will play out. And things are really lumpy. And you can be in a structural shift in different industries and still be a cyclical industry. Like the auto industry is cyclical, right? So, but you can still be in a structural shift. So all of these things can be true. It's just a matter of then how you price it if you're an investor.
Yeah.
And that gets complicated.
It does get complicated. And I just wonder to what extent, if any, this EV transition, at least in the United States, has become politicized.
Oh,
blue,
my gosh, yeah.
Blue, red.
Totally.
You know, and if that's, in fact, the case, then that really, I think, is a significant roadblock for the mass adoption, the mass volume that the economics demand to get the unit profitability there, because it's not. You barely make a profit at $70,000 or $80,000 a car. And as Kevin Tynan of Bloomberg Intelligence points out, how are you going to make a profit at $30,000 or $40,000?
Yep, exactly.
So
exactly.
I don't know.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
We are at Bloomberg NEF, Summit Day 2. So, Paul, one of my bigger takeaways from yesterday when we were here is that you have a lot of money being spent on stuff.
Yep.
And that's the good part. The other part is there's still a lot of uncertainty in terms of, are we spending it on the right stuff?
Yep.
Is the demand really there? Permitting is an issue, connection delays, trade issues. There's lots of stuff that we're trying to unpack here. One way to look at it is the importance of big energy in this space. So you need Exxon, Chevron, Shell, Total, BP. You need these guys to put money in the right spot to really help turn things around. So one of those individuals we're going to talk to right now is Jeff Gustavson.
Gustavson.
I can't do it. I asked him.
That's all right.
Gustavson. It's the V and
he's
the S,
cool.
Jeff. This is
cool.
My problem. He's president of Chevron New Energies. He's been at Chevron for, what was it, 25 years, you said?
25 years.
You've held lots of different positions. What brought you to the new energy part of Chevron? What's that like for you?
Yeah. Well, first of all, great to be here. Thanks for having me. We launched these new businesses about 3 years ago. This is actually our third full year, and it's a suite of businesses that support our lower carbon strategy as a company. There's two pieces to that. One is lowering the carbon intensity of our traditional oil and gas business. The other part is growing new low carbon businesses and solutions to scale. And that's what Chevron New Energies is. We're focused on renewable fuels, carbon capture, utilization, and storage, hydrogen, carbon offsets, emerging technologies, and everything in between. This is something that's always been a passion of mine, the energy transition and low carbon energy. I love oil and gas. I grew up in oil and gas. But now shifting, seeing a company like Chevron with the capabilities we bring to this space, growing these new businesses, I couldn't be more excited about this role.
And I always look to the educational background of our guest because I think that's kind of fun. University of Colorado, he's a Buffalo.
Oh,
that's big. And he's also got his MBA from the Red McCombs School of Business at the University of Texas. Red McCombs is a co-founder of Clear Channel, a little radio company I took public back in the day.
Mm.
So I know Red pretty well. And Larry Mays likes to say, hey, I got my name on the MBA program at Texas A&M for $10 million. Red, you spent $50 million. I got a better deal.
You got a better deal.
Yep. Jeff, what is, I don't know, if we fast forward 5 years from now, 10 years from now, how do you guys think about sustainable energy as a part of the overall portfolio of Chevron? What percentage do you think that might look like?
Yeah, good question. And when we announced that we were, you know, allocating or guiding to spending $10 billion over an 8-year period, right? This would be 2021 to 2028. And that's just the starting point. So these are already a significant part of our capital allocation strategy. We have a very large oil and gas business, which requires a lot of capital to maintain and grow that business to meet global demand. But these businesses, we're spending anywhere from $1.5 to $2 billion a year to support these new businesses. And my job and our job as a new segment is to find the right opportunities that are investable so we can grow this business even further.
So Paul asked this question in break, and I actually think it's a good one, so I'm going to ask it. You're based in Houston, and his question was, are guys like you, the new energy people, are you guys welcome in Houston?
Like the oilman's bar that I would go to.
He's thinking like the cowboy guys who stick like a pipe in the ground and get oil. He's thinking those people. Are you welcome in those bars?
Yes. and I love being referred to as a new energy person. I think there's three things that we really need to see in order to accelerate the growth of these businesses, and that's greater collaboration between private companies and policymakers, between governments around the world. It's lowering the cost of these new technologies and solutions, so large customers, large businesses, or individual customers will buy them. And it is bringing capabilities to bear, the right capabilities. And that goes to your Houston question. The energy industry possesses a lot of the capabilities, technical, operating, commercial capabilities that are required to grow these businesses profitably to scale. So absolutely, you know, a lot of activity in Houston, a lot of companies engaged in this. So Houston, it's an oil and gas capital. That's how it's thought of. It's also a new energy capital.
So where are we in terms of, I've been reading a lot on this. Alex, she knows that she's the expert. I've been reading up a lot on this over the last several days. Seems like the U.S. government's putting a lot of money into this. That's the good news, as Alex mentioned earlier. But I've also heard here over the last couple of days, it's still not easy doing business with the government. I'm thinking permitting for certain projects and things like that. What's been your experience there as to, is the government doing the best it can to kind of facilitate some of these investments and transition?
Yeah, so collaboration between the private sector and the public sector is fundamental here. It helps lower the cost. Those are, you know, advocacy, understanding politics, not just in this country but around the world, is a strength of our company, of energy companies, you know, more broadly. So it fits one of our existing capabilities. But that is one of the starting points here. You know, you need the right policy support, the right incentives to get the private sector investing even more heavily in this space. That will drive the technology forward, that will drive innovation, that will drive to building large-scale projects, which will lower the cost, make it more consumable for the world. And that is a cycle that will then, you know, continue. So it starts with policy, but it really is sustained by the investment by the private sector in technology. Government's a very important partner. We've seen, we're having really constructive conversations with the government, but you mentioned permitting. There's still a long way to go to make all of this come together. We've shown some progress, but there are many steps in front of us.
You know, Paul, though, to your point, it seems like the good part of this is that energy companies in the new energy world are in the room talking to people.
Yep.
Typically, the government and oil and gas have a contentious relationship at best in certain administrations, and it feels like in this area, maybe that is dissolving a bit, which would be helpful. Something that I've noticed, too, is that I think it was like $303 billion has been spent, I think it was last year, on all these new energy stuff. What I'm also hearing is that demand is a forgotten problem. Like, the money being spent on supplying the stuff and getting that cost down, but not enough is being spent on demand to incentivize a company signing up with you for ESAF or something along those lines. Is that true?
There is a lot of money being spent in these new businesses. It's actually $1.7 trillion globally, compared to about $1 trillion spent in the traditional energy business last year. And we need even more to grow these businesses to scale. And you hit on a very important point. It is, and I'll use hydrogen as an example. It's not hard to produce hydrogen. It's harder to produce low-carbon hydrogen at a low cost, something that we're working on using natural gas as a feedstock or using electricity and renewable power as feedstocks to produce low-carbon hydrogen. But transporting hydrogen to the market, you need policy support in order to do that. You need technological innovation to do that, to lower the cost. And then importantly, encouraging consumers to buy hydrogen, making it easier for them to transition from a traditional product that they're using today to a lower carbon product that comes at a higher cost. That's where demand incentives and policy support will also be required.
What's the biggest headwind you guys have been facing over the last 3 years as you begin this transition? Has it been on the regulatory governmental front? Has it been capital, getting capital from your CFO? Where's it been?
No, there's always a lot of challenges when you're starting up new businesses. But it's very, very exciting, and we're making tremendous, you know, progress. We've identified probably a dozen large foundational projects in all of these sectors around not just the U.S. but around the world. We're the second largest bio-based diesel producer in the United States. We've got a large, you know, CCUS hub on the U.S. Gulf Coast. We've got a large hydrogen project in Utah that we're growing. So we're making a lot of progress. There's always challenges along the way. How do you prioritize the best opportunities? How do you advocate for the right policies? How do you create the right culture to support these businesses? We have a fantastic culture in our company. We're using all of that and more. But you have to think about these businesses in a different way. There are challenges, but it has been very rewarding at the same time.
He's not going to answer that question, Paul.
Well, we'll see. I'm looking at the stock here.
I thought I did answer it.
We're looking for, like, hey, what's really hard? What stresses you out?
Well, it's all hard.
Yeah.
And so all of that, you know, how can we collaborate, you know, more aggressively? Mm-hmm. How can we lower the cost faster?
Yeah.
How can we bring all of the capabilities we have to bear here? How do we make sure that everyone remains committed
yep. mm-hmm.
to this? Not just us, but everyone in this ecosystem to drive these businesses forward. So those are all big challenges.
Yep.
I'm not discounting that,
Jeff.
But I'm very excited about what we're doing.
Got to leave it there, Jeff. Really appreciate it. Jeff Gustafson. I'm going to get it. President of Chevron New Energies. I'm going to work towards that for sure. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
We're at Bloomberg NEF Summit Day 2. We're in the middle of the Hubbubaloo. We're in our Intercontinental Hotel on 48th Street down in Midtown Manhattan. And it's all about getting world leaders and CEOs and thought leaders and analysts together to sort of tackle this energy transition, where we are now, and then where do we go to, and how do we do that? Well, joining us now is our next guest, Andy Vesey. He's president and CEO of Fortescue North America, and he joins us now. Andy, good to see you.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for having me.
So I do follow this industry quite closely, and I was like, what? Fortescue is a metal company. What's going on? It's based in Australia. What are you doing here talking about hydrogen?
Well, Fortescue was a metal company. In fact, it still is. It's the fourth largest producer of iron ore in the world and the lowest cost operator. But our founder, Andrew Forrest, came to the realization that carbon emissions was having a significant impact on the planet, and it was happening quickly, and that his business contributed to that. And so he made a commitment that he was going to decarbonize his metals business, Scope 1 and Scope 2 emissions, by 2030. And in thinking about doing that, he had to think about all the technologies he needed to make that happen, and many of them weren't available commercially. So he decided that he was going to create that ecosystem. One component of that was green hydrogen, because he needed green hydrogen to do a number of things to replace diesel fuel in his mining operations. But then he realized there were a lot of other things he needed, and a lot of more things he needed. So what Fortescue is today, while it still has a metals group, it now has an energies group, but we describe ourselves as an integrated green technology, energy, and metals group. And they're all coming together, and it's one Fortescue now. So that's why we're here, and I happen to have the privilege of trying to be on the side of the business that produces green hydrogen, specifically in North America.
What is green hydrogen?
Okay, well, it's hydrogen, but it's made from green energy, which would include solar, wind, and hydro.
So just to Alex explain to you here.
Please.
So you have something called an electrolyzer where you get water in and you separate the hydrogen from the water, and how you power that determines the color of that hydrogen. So if you power it with, say, coal, it's going to be gray. If you power it with natural gas, it's going to be blue. If you power it with solar and wind, it's going to be green. Right. And
I
learned something again. But now I'm guessing there's a tax issue here. I'm reading all throughout your notes, 45V. Dumb it down for somebody like me, a media guy.
Yeah, so look, the bottom line is that 70% of a green molecule made what would be called electrolytic because it uses electricity. 70% of the cost of that molecule is the cost of that green electron. And so if you're going to be in this business, you would say, well, I'm going to go every place where the renewable energy is really, really cheap, right? You're going to go to North Africa. You're going to be in Australia. You might be in parts of Latin America. But where you would not be would be in the U.S., right? Because we know it's expensive. But there's another thing about the U.S. It's probably one of the largest consumers of gray hydrogen or hydrogen that's produced from methane gas. So there's a huge market here. But the challenge is getting to a price point where people will buy it. Well, the U.S. government also understood this and understood that to decarbonize hard-to-abate sectors, meaning sectors that can't use a green electron to meet emission reduction goals, need a green molecule. And so the Biden administration decided, well, what we need to do is assist in getting the price down, get the industry started, and then eventually through scale and involvement in the market, the price will come down naturally on the learning curve, right? So they came up with the idea of providing a tax incentive, right, a PTC, that you can get direct cash for. So it would help lower the end product price to customers. And the maximum you can get would be $3 a kilogram, and that's based on the carbon intensity of that molecule. So all non-gray molecules, right, all those molecules not produced or that have don't have carbon emissions at some level would get a rising incentive. Okay, brilliant, right? Now companies like Fortescue, who is investing all over the world, decides we're going to put capital in the United States, right? We're going to develop technology in the United States because this could be a big market, right? But there was an expectation of how that would come out. And when the rules were written, it's now called 45E because it's a section in the IRS code, came out in such a way that it didn't actually help us. To some degree, it hurt early movers because of how strict the rules were.
Meaning that, from what I understand it, is that normally you could say, look, I'm going to buy this much wind and solar over the course of a year. Give me the credit. But they want hour for hour matching. So if you use energy for an hour, that needs to be solar and that needs to be counted. And that's very difficult because that's not predictable with wind and solar. And you also don't have it.
Right. See, you understand this perfectly.
Well,
That's one of the pillars, right?
Okay.
But probably the most problematic. And I'll give you a reason why. So you said it earlier. We use an electrolyzer, right? We take electricity and we split the water into oxygen and hydrogen. That's what we do. On terms of when you're going to be using the energy, that's called temporal matching. And it exists because there are no 100% green grids in the U.S. So there's always the concern by adding additional load, you potentially are going to use fossil-based energy to meet it. All right? So the view is, how are you going to do the temporal matching? All right? So if I have a 1 megawatt electrolyzer, I need to have 3 times that much capacity in the market if I'm matching on an annual basis, because I get to average it over the year. And over a year, perfect, right? If you go to monthly matching, you need 5 times as much energy. But an hourly, you need 7 times, right? So if I'm building a gigawatt of electrolyzers in Texas, I may only need a gigawatt of energy at any time, but I have to buy 7 times that to ensure that I have all the probabilities working so I know I can match in that hour, which means that the bulk of what I buy, I don't need. So I'm going to have to be buying and selling energy, and that's equivalent to almost, you know, between 5 and 10% of the annual, I mean, the daily load in the ERCOT system. I mean, it's massive. So what are the implications? Well, there are two. The way 45V is structured today, A, it will absolutely increase the price of the product. Now, remember, the whole idea of this was to decrease the price of the product. It will increase the price of the project anywhere between 150 to 175% to the consumer, okay? The second thing is because of the massive amount of energy we have to buy, all right, we have to make the project smaller so you can actually transact that. The third point, because of, again, annual this hourly matching, there are only certain places you can do it, so there are fewer opportunities to get it done, all right? And if we have to do one other thing, which is part of the 45E, we have to add new green electrons, well, that can take years and years. So we are doing everything against the original intent, right? And why are we doing this? Because we're thinking about the perfect solution at the beginning, right? We want the perfect projects. The idea should be, no, we're building an industry which ultimately will work. Let's not handicap it at the beginning, because like any other industry, the more market interactions you have, the more things you build, the more things that fail, the more supply chains that get created, the more people who get trained. That's what building an industry is. And unfortunately, we're thinking about projects.
Yeah.
Right? One-off projects, and that's just wrong.
All right, Andy, we really appreciate it. It's complex.
It's a lot of
really
chemistry
helped us break it down.
Thing.
It is a lot of chemistry.
I didn't know that.
I was actually weirdly good at chemistry, but it's all forgotten, of course. Andy Veazey, President and CEO of Fortescue Industries here in North America. Really appreciate it. Thank you so much. I guess the takeaway, and we haven't even dealt with the demand side. Like,
nope.
Then you have to make the demand be there. People are going to have to buy that product, and that gets really,
right.
And that's also very difficult.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
I'm Alex Steele alongside Paul Sweeney. This is Bloomberg Intelligence Radio, and we are live from Bloomberg NEF Summit Day 2 in the Intercontinental Hotel right here in New York City. The summit really provides a chance for CEOs, thought leaders, world leaders, politicians to kind of get together in a room and talk about the issues facing the energy transition, how you get from zero to 100, how do you get from here to there in a meaningful way that is also price efficient and makes profits and does stuff and is cheap enough. We spent about, the U.S., I should say, spent about $303 billion last year on the transition.
Wow.
Worldwide over
That's
a
real.
Trillion. And there's still a lot of problems, things like permitting, demand, trade issues. We just saw earlier today, maybe President Biden will look at an increased tariff from steel
okay.
and
yep,
aluminum
that's right.
In China. So how do you deal with that if you're running a company? Well, Anna Moscolo is Chief Executive Vice President of Low Carbon Solutions over at Shell. She's been with Shell for about 20 years and has had many different jobs within the company and has landed here in the past 2 years, right?
Two or three years.
Two or
yes.
three years. Okay.
Yes.
How's it going?
Well, so it's going well. We are progressing. Energy transition probably is progressing well overall. And we have seen big strides in electrification. But at the same time, in my lifetime, oil demand has doubled. And we
right.
still see sectors like aviation, shipping, and commercial road transport, buses and trucks, where we see demand increasing in the coming years. And these sectors need, the hard-to-abate sectors need solutions to support that, so biofuels or biogases.
So I think what we've learned maybe over the last several years with the invasion of Ukraine is just how important traditional energy, carbon energy is for the global trade. So as we make this transition to a more sustainable energy mm-hmm. grid, we still have to invest there. How does your company think about that? How does a huge company like Shell think about that?
It's all about balance, probably, and making sure that we have probably two things, that we pace ourselves with our customers in making sure that we transition with the right pace in different places, and that changes by country and by geography. But also that we focus on the solutions where we have a real competitive advantage. If I think about, for example, the LNG market, we have seen LNG actually playing a big role in being providing flexible and secure supplies in the last two or three years.
And LNG is under your purview, right?
LNG is part, yes, of the...
Which is interesting, because not every company is going to look at LNG in the new carbon low solutions business.
Yeah, so the traditional LNG business does not sit with me. Mm. But what my team does is actually using the LNG for example, the marine sector. So we match LNG and our traditional position globally in LNG trading with customers. So the marine sector sits with me, and we are transferring and selling LNG for the marine sectors instead of fuel oil. And that provides for lower carbon intensity products.
Are there certain industries that your customers, you mentioned the marine industry, and I didn't even think about that when this discussion started 10 years ago about how they burn so much fuel, but when I see them off or out on my beach, when I'm sitting on my beach chair, I see the smoke out the back of the thing. So what industries are doing a good job in making the transition, and what maybe industries still need some work from your perspective?
So as I said, we've made great progress on the decarbonizing through electrification. The areas that are a bit more stubborn are the planes, the trucks, the ships, and also the heavy industry. So industry that need high intensity heat. Like cement, steel, fertilizers, chemical industries. And in those cases, you need what we call drop-in fuels, like biofuels or synthetic fuels, whether liquid or gas. So high energy intensity. And different sector is moving at different paces in different regions. And of course, we shouldn't forget that regulatory environment, certainty around how things should develop is very important. Whether it is carrot or stick.
Yeah, we talked a lot carrot and stick on the panel earlier today. You also mentioned when I was talking to you about how you guys look at returns for the different investments. So if you look at oil and gas returns straight up is say 15% plus.
Correct.
Then how do you judge the returns for different projects in low carbon solutions?
Yeah, it's important to recognize that different products and different solutions are available at different scales. So for our traditional businesses, we are looking upstream and marketing, we are looking at 15 plus. For biofuels, electrical vehicles, where we have positions today, we are one of the biggest suppliers of biofuels and traders today. For EV, we have already 54,000 charging points globally. So for those one, we are looking at a 12%. And for solutions that are not quite there and they need scale, and we have been a bit more selective in our investments, like hydrogen and CCS, it's 10 plus. So we are being targeted around our approach on returns, and that also will change over time as the industry changes. And also when we're looking at our overall investment profile, last year with 23% of our capital was spent in low carbon energy solutions, so EV, biofuels, biogases, and renewable generations. That was 5.6 billion, by the way.
You know, boy, I'm looking at your revenue contribution, where it comes. I mean, you're truly a global company, obviously, Shell, with roughly a third out of Europe, a third out of Asia and Africa, and a third out of, I guess, the Americas. So truly a global company. Are there certain parts of the world where you have had more success and maybe, you know, in terms of making these investments and seeing change versus some other parts of the world?
We see that it's easier when we have clarity from the regulatory perspective.
Okay.
So Europe, US, Canada, we have seen, whether it is carrot or stick, we have seen clarity around mandates, tax incentives, and so on. But all this being said, by the way, we are also seeing Asia picking up. The way China is going around EVs, for example, and electrical charging points. We are seeing in Southeast Asia development of carbon capture and storage. India also, we made an investment recently in India Spring Energy, where we are investing in renewable generation. So actually Asia, and everybody knows that the moment it comes and it picks up, the volumes will be there.
What's it like being a company in Europe versus if you were a company in the U.S., in that Europe deals with a lot of sticks, U.S. typically has the carrots, but the governments are supportive in different ways. It's much more bifurcated in the U.S. What's the hardest part of all of that?
Probably the hardest part is making sure that there are clear trade-offs between sectors. So let me give you an example. If I want to use hydrogen, greener hydrogen, do I use it for commercial road transport or do I use it for passenger cars? Well, actually, probably passenger cars, I can use it for EV. So making sure that the regulatory environment matches with the sectors you need to address. So hydrogen for commercial road transport in the future or heavy industries, that would be a solution. So trying to incentivize use of the scarce hydrogen we will have available and we have available into the industry that needs it most. And then the other thing is probably the stability. So you could, these are longer term investments. You need to make investments that are multi-billion over 10, 15 years, 20 years time. You need to have certainty of the regulatory environment and direction of travel. And the industry needs to move in tandem, supply and demand. We cannot build projects if our customers also don't invest. Mm-hmm. Carbon capture and storage is a quite a good one where our customers need to invest in the capture of the CO2. And we invest in the transport and the storage to bring the CO2 under the ground.
Mm-hmm. What's the next big road, a milepost that someone like me who doesn't follow this day-to-day, what should I look for? Is there a piece of news? Is there a piece of legislation or something that's going to be a big milepost that, boy, this industry is continuing to make progress?
We would want to see that carbon pricing is reflected in starting to see that there is an opportunity and incentives for people to switch and move on. That's one trend you would be looking at. Then stability of the regulatory environment is another mm-hmm. one. And then the other thing I would say is there is not a single solution that fits all. So for every sector, we have a roadmap and we work with our customers
yep.
to look at what is available. And again, we start from our position of strengths, LNG, EV, biofuels, and then building on that with hydrogen CCS. And probably in the future, we direct our capture if and when that will happen at scale.
Anna, thanks so much. Super appreciate it. Anna Moscolo, she is Shell Executive Vice President for Low Carbon Solutions. Really interesting. And yep. we have more coming up.
I know, more coming up. More
Are you
stuff.
Into it?
I am. I'm getting into it. Now
I
that
can see.
You know, you get traditional energy companies and the new energy companies, they got to be together, which yes. they are at this conference at least. So we'll see.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
I'm Alex Deal alongside Paul Sweeney. We are live at the Bloomberg NEF Summit right here in Midtown Manhattan, where we're covering all the top regulators, officials, CEOs, analysts, strategy officers within the energy transition space. How do you get from oil and gas to something different, and what does that actually wind up looking like? So here's a quiz for you.
Yep.
What is the third best performing stock in the S&P this year?
I'm going to guess it's an energy stock.
Yes, it is.
Ding, 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 ding.
Ding, ding, ding. Paul's the best. it is Constellation Energy, which is the largest nuclear power facility in the country. It also is the largest provider of power to, like, C&I customers. And that's really interesting because you have Supermicro as the best performing stock, then NVIDIA, and then you have Constellation Energy, GE, and NRG Energy. And what all of this has in common is a lot of demand for data centers, a boost in power demand, and a need for that power. And nuclear is really front and center for that. So joining us now to discuss is Kathleen Barron. She's Executive Vice President and Chief Strategy Officer. She joins us now here at the summit. Kathleen, it's a pleasure. Thanks for for joining.
Thanks, Alex. Happy to be here.
So, funnily enough, I talked to your CEO yesterday on TV. So if you guys want to hear more about nuclear, you can check out that segment from Bloomberg Television, The Close. Let's talk about what other stuff you guys are doing. Nuclear, obviously bread and butter. In the energy transition space, of which nuclear is a big part, what else are you guys doing, looking at, paying money for?
Well, one of the opportunities we see ahead of our country is to find ways to decarbonize industrial sector. It's a huge source of emissions, and it's really hard to find a way to run steel manufacturing, agriculture, aviation, long-haul shipping on electricity, right? So we have to find another way to decarbonize that sector and find a liquid or gaseous or a solid fuel that we're going to have at the ready at any moment to power those industries. And hydrogen has emerged as an opportunity for the U.S. now that the Inflation Reduction Act has passed. There's a production tax credit for hydrogen in that act. And we see nuclear and hydrogen as an ideal pairing because, as you pointed out, nuclear is clean, but it's also firm. It's reliable. It runs 24/7. And so it can be a steady source of power to run into an electrolyzer, split water into oxygen and hydrogen, and then create that clean molecule that can power industrial applications.
What color
with a clean
is that?
Fuel. Well, we're trying to discourage the rainbow of colors and just talk about clean versus emitting.
Coffee.
But it is called pink for what it's worth.
Okay, just so we're clear.
Yep. So I was fascinated to know, I didn't know much about your company. Your company has the largest or the biggest nuclear fleet in the country with 21 reactors. What is the future of nuclear energy in this country as we, again, think about more green types of energy sources?
You know, it has changed a lot even just in the last few years in terms of public acceptance for the technology.
Totally.
It makes, not just our fleet, but the nuclear fleet generally generates 20% of the electricity that runs through this building we're in and our economy every day. People don't really realize that, but it is the backbone of the power sector, and it is carbon-free and, as we just talked about, very reliable. It operates around the clock, no matter the weather, sun, wind, rainstorm. It's still operating. And we own 21 reactors. We operate 21 reactors. We own 23. And so that's about a quarter of the U.S. fleet. And the beauty of these machines is that they can run for a very long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Most of our assets are sort of in the 30, 40, 50-year-old time frame. But they can run up to 80 years, according to the federal safety regulators in Washington. And so they are constantly being rebuilt. We put in about $1.5 billion of new capital every year, and we're replacing the components. It's kind of like an old car that's having its parts replaced regularly. So these machines can run for a very long time. They abate about 500 million metric tons of carbon every year. So it's in the nation's interest to keep them running, and with this growing public acceptance, we're seeing interest in corporate procurements, we're seeing interest from governments, we're seeing people valuing this thing that we don't have enough of, which is a clean, firm megawatt hour.
So when we talk about the hydrogen stuff, so pink, so basically you would get the power to split the hydrogen from the oxygen in the electrolyzer
more
using nuclear.
Chemistry.
Does that mean that if I'm building a hydrogen facility, I have to go where your power plant is? Or are you going to be building a power plant, a small modular power plant near me? Or are we running like a big tube of something in between me and you?
So what we're talking about is using the existing reactors to power an electrolyzer and, as you said, split the oxygen and the hydrogen. You could do that right up next to the power plant, so you put the electricity right into the electrolyzer, or you could put your electrolyzer next to your manufacturing plant or whatever process you're trying to use the hydrogen for. Say you're making sustainable aviation fuel, and we can ship the electricity over the transmission line to your electrolyzer with a dedicated power purchase agreement. That's sort of hydrogen by wire configuration. So either co-located with the plant or through the transmission line, either way, you're going to have that steady source of zero carbon electricity going into the electrolyzer every hour.
Hmm.
Can I go out and build a nuclear power plant in this country today?
There is no reason why you can't.
But,
thank you, Alex. You know, there are a bunch of reactor technology developers who have new designs.
Yep.
You mentioned small modular reactors that are in the process of getting licensed. And there are some utilities who have created relationships with those technology developers for sort of, co-development or, you know, an advanced commitment. But none of them are under construction just yet. Some of them are going to be starting soon. For example, in Canada, the Ontario Power Generator has partnered with the GE 300-megawatt reactor design to, and they think they have been through regulatory approvals and they will start construction sooner. But in the U.S., we've lagged. I mean, this is happening in Canada, it's happening overseas, and we don't have that sort of market pull here. We don't have commitments as much as we should to get those new reactor designs through licensing and into construction and past that first-of-a-kind cost cycle. That's really the thing that we need to overcome.
Yeah, we kind of jumped over nuclear for a while, right? Like, yep. When I first started covering commodities 17 years ago, it was all uranium because of the nuclear stuff, and then it was like, we don't talk about that right now. And even Germany was, like, anti-nuclear for a while. They retired all their fleets, and now they're like, oopsie, what happens when Russia invades Ukraine? Kathleen, so great to get your perspective. That was really great. Love to see how that relationship pans out between hydrogen and nuclear. Kathleen Barron, she's Executive Vice President and Chief Strategy Officer over at Constellation Energy.
I'm learning a lot these past couple days.
I'm so
happy. All in.
I thought you were going to be so bored.
No,
I'm so psyched.
Cool. Yeah, a little bit more chemistry than I thought. You know, I didn't think there would be math here, but I'll figure it out.
It's helpful with the H2O. It's like, right, okay.
Yes, I got
two
that.
Two hydrogen, one oxygen.
Yep.
We got this. We can do this.
Yep.
We can do math.
This is the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live each weekday, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern, on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
What could you do if your data was working for you and not against you? With Bloomberg delivering enterprise data directly to your systems, you get easy access to the details you want, optimized for higher-level analysis, and financial data experts committed to helping you maximize your every move. Our data is made for more, so you can show the world what you're made of. Visit Bloomberg.com/enterprise data to learn more.